flake effect snow kicks in later today, it could increase snowfall amounts. Current snowfall prediction, 48 inches by nightfall. High today, 26 degrees. Right now it's 21 degrees. Wind from the south at 10. Wind chill 7 above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10. The Morning Show with Greg Berg up next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at jackanddrea.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And for this Martin Luther King Day, I am very, very grateful to have three special guests in the studio. First, I want to mention Dr. Jonathan Shaler, who has been on the program before, a professor of communication at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and he has been on the program on a number of occasions to talk about different things, but probably most often to talk about the Shakespeare Prison Project at the Racine Correctional Institution. He is the founder and director of that extraordinary project. He is also founder and director of the Certificate Program in Conflict Analysis and Resolution. And we're going to be talking not only about Dr. King and his legacy today, but also about a course that Dr. Shaler will be teaching in the near future on conflict analysis and intervention. I told Dr. Shaler that it would be great to have him on the program today, and I think it was he who had the idea of maybe extending a word of invitation to several colleagues of his at Parkside who might also enjoy being here in the studio to talk about Dr. King and his legacy and the issues that have very much yet to be resolved in our current climate. So he has extended invitations that were accepted by, first of all, Heather Kind Keppel, who is the Diversity and Inclusion Officer at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside and a lecturer in ethnic studies and someone whose academic career has involved a number of different projects and assignments. And then Renee Sarton Kirby, who has been at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside for more than a quarter century, serving a number of different roles. Currently, she is Director of Student Health Counseling and Disability Services, and she also has on her resume service as a public school exceptional education teacher and executive trainer for a management consulting firm. And she's the wife of a pastor, namely Bishop Lawrence Kirby, Senior Pastor of St. Paul Baptist Church in Racine. We are grateful to all three of you for braving the elements and joining us today on this special edition of the Morning Show. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Professor Shaler, you're the one who extended the invitations. Tell me, first of all, sort of what you thought about in terms of who to invite to join you on this program today.
Sure. I just knew that I didn't want to be here alone. This is
very scary.
Yeah. Well, no. It's such a, you're a very scary man, Greg. No, this is a really important day, and I wanted us to emphasize how Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy is a community legacy, that it affects all of us, that we have experiences and stories. And I also wanted us to touch in on his words and not just talk about him in a perfunctory way, but hear his words.
Right. And towards that ending, and this was your idea and a fantastic idea, it was that everybody here in this room has come with a particular passage from Dr. King's work, either an excerpt from one of the magnificent speeches he delivered or from one of a number of different books that he wrote. And it's very nice how they happen to highlight various facets of who he was and what was most important to him. So I think this is going to work out very, very nicely. Let's stay with you for just a moment more, Professor Shaler. When you think of Dr. King, we're not getting into the readings yet, but when you think about a day like Martin Luther King Day, what do you think is of paramount importance for us as Americans in 2017?
The fierce urgency of now, to use words from one of his most famous speeches, and the fact that Dr. King not only was the most highly recognized leader of the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, but the issues that he was addressing still exist, and they were not confined to those of race relations, although those are central. It was also militarism. It was also poverty. And those issues are still central in our nation and much in need of being addressed. And I think one of the reasons he is so important is that he had just such a clearly and richly articulated vision. And his words were not mere words, they were actions. And if we return to those words, I think we would benefit.
Absolutely. Renee Sarton Kirby, I'm really anxious to know what Dr. King means to you personally and to, for instance, your family, and particularly what your memories are of what he has meant to you, in a sense, throughout your life.
Sure. I think one of the first thoughts that came to my mind as I was reflecting this weekend about Dr. King and his legacy and what he has meant to my family personally was the remembrance of an uncle, an aunt in his family, who in 1967, I believe, he was a prominent dentist in Milwaukee, and they were looking for a home. And because of the housing discrimination and the redlining in the Milwaukee area, could not purchase one in Mequon. And so through a friend of his who was Jewish, they purchased a home in Mequon on Zedler Lane, and they were the first African Americans to do so at the time. And I looked back at the picture of the family on the cover of the community journal or community page section of the Milwaukee Journal at the time, and he seemed very pleased and proud. And I looked at my aunt's face, and I could see the stress or distress that the experience, I think, had caused her as a mother, an African-American woman. And ironically, 32 years later, his son won a housing discrimination lawsuit on the south side of Milwaukee, as he and his Latina partner had difficulty renting a home. And I as Jonathan has said, some of the problems still exist in our community, then as well as now.
Absolutely. Yeah, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I think that's actually one thing that I find myself thinking about so much, that there is obviously much to celebrate in terms of
yes.
how much the world has changed
yes.
Since, for instance, the time of Dr. King, and even through the space of his own lifetime, how much changed and how much he had to do with that. And yet, at the same time, how at least large swaths of many of these same issues are still with us in various ways. Heather Kind-Keppel, you are Diversity and Inclusion Officer at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. So you come to this table in somewhat a same different capacity, and yet I want to begin with, on a more sort of personal level, what the legacy of Dr. King means to you.
Sure. You know, I agree with, excuse me, with both what, you know, Jonathan and Renee have said, that he was, you know, just pivotal in the history of this country. And I think in many ways, as I reflected this weekend, I think it sounds like we all did a lot of introspection and preparation for this morning. As much as a visionary he was, I think he was ahead of his time, because as I read things, and, you know, it's 55 years this August since he gave, you know, we had his dream speech on the Mall. And I think, you know, I think sometimes we just, you know, I have a dream is that one catchphrase, but to reread it, I wanted to reread the speech, you know, prior to coming on the air. And there's so much more to that speech that's so powerful. And, you know, I have a dream is kind of the catch that we all hear, but, oh, just reading the transcripts. And I guess I would encourage everyone to read it this year, before, you know, the 55th anniversary. But I think, you know, like both of my colleagues have said, he was ahead of his time. And I think if Dr. King was still with us today, I think he would say a lot of the same things. You know, as I was reading the Why We Can't Wait, he was frustrated when he was writing that in 63 and 64. And that was
How frustrated he would be now.
And exactly. So he was talking about his frustration with Brown versus Board of Education. It's 2018, and I think a lot of those sentiments would just be mind-boggling. I'm not quite sure what he would say at this point.
Right.
Because that was just, you know, 10 years later. And so I think his frustration would be exponentially felt.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about how so much of what he said and wrote through the course of his lifetime is still so applicable today.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like you have to take it, but then sort of shift it through a shifter and make it relevant. It remains heartbreakingly relevant to this very day.
And I think it's unfortunate. I'm not sure everyone does take the time to fully read it. I think we pull out quotes, you know, we pull out quotes for today, but you have to read them in context because then you get the full brevity of what he was truly saying and how very relevant it continues to be.
Professor Shaler, before we start digging into these specific readings that people have brought with them, as a professor of communication, I'm especially anxious to hear what you have to say about what you think were the most sort of powerful facets of Dr. King's skills when it came to just wielding words. I mean, what was it about his words that gave them such power?
I'm probably going to get a little help on this one, but I think that you know, he came from a prophetic tradition. He came from a preaching tradition. And he, several generations of pastors, as he said, I didn't really have much choice in terms of a vocation. His father was a preacher, his father's father, and I think maybe even a generation prior to that. So this was very much in his blood. And if you listen to the cadences, you really need to hear him speak, not just read the words, I think. And his speeches are widely available, despite the tight control that some of his materials are under. You can still access all of the recordings, and there are wonderful documentaries, et cetera. but the cadences of his speech, it's like music. He sang some of those speeches, and his what we call in public speaking, his ethos, his speaker credibility. You had no doubt at any given moment that this is a man who's speaking from the greatest depths of his being. And wow, that's something that really makes an impact. So did you want to add anything?
I do, because that ethos comes from his knowledge of the written language and his words. And I was listening to public radio this morning, and Nikki Giovanni was on talking about how language and words are empowering. And so in even the selection or paragraph that I've chosen, he is quoting from a monk, a Buddhist monk. He's quoting from Langston Hughes. So his ability to weave passages of poetry and prose and scholars, you know, whether it's T.S. Eliot, into the preached word with that cadence is really what gives life to what he did and how he did it. Yeah.
So one of the things you're talking about there is how well-read he was.
Yes.
And he is not, in a sense, just speaking from his own heart, but speaking from a wealth of of other thinkers and other writers and many who have spoken and written on these over the generations. Well, then let's have you, Renee Sarton Kirby, let's have you begin by sharing with us what you have brought as one of your favorite passages of Dr. King. Looks like this is something from 1967, so relatively late in his career.
Yes, it was a year before his assassination and the support of those in Memphis who were striking, the public workers who were striking. It's Beyond Vietnam, which he really wrestled with and was advised not to give this speech in New York at the time. A time comes when silence is betrayal. Some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that the calling to speak is often a vocation of agony, but we must speak. We must speak with all the humility that is appropriate to our limited vision, but we must speak. And we must rejoice as well, for surely this is the first time in our nation's history that a significant number of its religious leaders have chosen to move beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism to the high grounds of a firm dissent based upon the mandates of conscience and the reading of history. Perhaps a new spirit is rising among us. If it is, let us trace its movement and pray that our inner being may be sensitive to its guidance. For we are deeply in need of a new way beyond the darkness that seems so close around us. So he's opposing the Vietnam War and militarism, and along with rising rates of poverty, and I'm thinking of immigration this weekend and the near miss, if you will, that happened. Unbeknownst to me, I had chosen this piece before the weekend transpired. And he realizes that we can't keep fighting. There are some things that we can't fight. We need to embrace nonviolence and negotiations. And so I thought a lot about that this weekend and the impact of this particular passage.
So many things leap out at me, but one of them is when he says, we must speak with all the humility that is appropriate to our limited vision, but we must speak.
Yes, yes.
It seems to me that one of the dangers of humility, if you are, in a sense, too humble or too aware of your own limitations, is that that can so easily be a paralyzing agent or a silencing agent that, well, I don't know that much. I don't know very much about the world or even about this important issue. I'm not sure I know enough that I should be speaking out on this. And what Dr. King is saying, even aware of your own limitations of the fact that you don't know everything, that doesn't mean you remain silent. And I'd never stopped to think about how what an interesting relationship there is, and to think about the spirit of humility that permeated so much of what Dr. King spoke and did. I mean, for as courageous a figure as he was, he did everything he did with that spirit of humility.
Yes, yes. And when good people fail to speak up, monstrosity perpetuates itself, and violence, and sometimes just saying this is wrong. You know, we may not have the eloquent words and access to the wealth of knowledge in our memory banks that he did, especially because of technology and the ability to Google things as opposed to having to memorize them when we were children maybe 60 years ago. But just for us to say, this is wrong and I don't agree, yes, can speak volumes and empower people to do so much more. Mm.
I'm also struck by the phrase where he talks about moving beyond prophesying about smooth patriotism, which is an interesting concept. Moving beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism to the high grounds of a firm descent. And you realize that, yes, there is something very comforting about smooth patriotism, which allows us to not confront maybe some of the darker or more vexing realities of our world, and particularly of our country and its struggles. That's a really intriguing concept as well, that one can be a great patriot. Mm-hmm. In some ways, you're embodying the best of patriotism when you are willing to ask these questions or raise these issues about one's country.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have a friend in public office, an associate friend, if you will, of a colleague of my husband's. And right now there's some tension because I don't agree with his stance. But it doesn't mean that I'm not, or he is not, patriotic. I support the government. He supports the government. But I think it's important for us to have that conversation about the areas in which we disagree.
Absolutely. Yes,
that is patriotism.
Yes.
Well, that's what it means to be an American
yeah,
in so many ways. For those of you just joining us, we have three special guests on the morning show today for Martin Luther King Day, three guests in our studio. We've just heard from Renee Sarton Kirby, who is the Director of Student Health Counseling and Disability Services at Parkside, with her Heather Kind-Keppel, who is the Diversity and Inclusion Officer at UW-Parkside, and Jonathan Shaler, Professor of Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Each of these guests has brought with them a favorite passage from Dr. King and his extraordinary legacy. Heather Kind-Keppel, let's hear what you want to share with us today.
I brought two that I really enjoy. I'm trying to decide which one I should talk about. I think, you know, I brought a quote from the letter from a Birmingham jail, which I believe is becoming more widely read, which I think is good. I think, again, people are really delving into more of his speeches and mm-hmm. getting really past that. And you know, I want to read the quote. Dr. King said, "First, I must confess that over the past few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride towards freedom is not the white citizen counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, 'I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action,' who paternalistically believes that he can set the timetable for another man's freedom." I feel like I should read that again. "Who lives by a mythical concept of time and who constantly advises the Negro to wait for a more convenient season. Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is more bewildering than outright rejection."
Wow. I am struck by so many things, but one of them, and from what read, Renee, the same thing, which is that these are not just beautiful words, I mean, beautifully woven together, but they are words of such exceptional insight. I mean, he says things that get us thinking about even the most basic facets of life in a way that we've often not thought of before. We don't feel like we're just being told things we already know, but just told them more beautifully, but we are given insights into things we haven't thought about. For instance, what's the problem with being moderate? Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't that something we should all try to be? But to think about moderation is actually a source of great frustration and a bigger and a bigger problem. I'm also struck by the whole thing he says about this idea that we have the right to set the timetable for another man's freedom. What does that mean to you?
You know, and that was another one I felt like I had to read twice. Like, not because we didn't hear it the first time, but just to really think about what, you know, people knowing that if they really thought about it, they truly did hold the timetable. And not understanding the gravity of that, you know, and not really thinking, you know, I remember reading things as a child, and I was always a quiet child. I read insatiably. And I think in many ways Dr. King, even at a young age, it was just so profound. And he, you know, contextually, that statement alone, you know, it really leads to the shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than the absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. You know, like, mm-hmm. you're not giving this enough thought. You're literally holding up someone's freedom.
Because, you know, what I think of in contemporary setting is Black Lives Matter and some of the reaction to that. Not that way, you know. There may be a way for you to protest, but not that way. And do not, you know, put those videos online. Mm-hmm. Do not make our police officers uncomfortable. Do not imply that everything isn't all right. There's also the taking the knee movement, which
provoke.
Is tied in. Right. Don't provoke.
Don't provoke.
Don't be disrespectful. Not during the national anthem. Mm-hmm. It's all about propriety rather than justice. And if there's a contest between propriety and justice, I will choose justice every time.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. But who are we to say for anyone what activism is, you know? I think even Dr. King had some pushback from other contemporaries, you know, and I think we have this mythical or romanticized idea of what activism is, right? So we have this idea of what an activist looks like or what they do, but there really is no checklist, you know, and I so admire Dr. King because he never wavered. Mm-hmm. He, despite pushback, despite, you know, you should be more this or that or more violent, he just really, truly believed in what he was doing, and I think that came through in everything he did. He was, you know, that genuine sense came through his speeches, it came through his actions, I think. And so for someone who, you know, may have received pushback, you're too quiet or you're too sensitive, well, here's someone who's validating that, you know? And so I think this was his form of activism.
Sure.
And he was very confident and comfortable with that.
And, of course, he's also touching on what was one of the greatest frustrations of his career, that in some respects, not exactly that it was easier, but maybe in some ways it was simpler to confront certain kinds of evil racism when it was wearing a hood and... Mm-hmm. and
it's overt.
Yeah.
Absolutely. A very overt kind of evil, and to confront... evil of a more subtle nature, in which
somebody recently did us a favor by expressing some overt evil a few days ago, and I think that was helpful in as a wake up call, a reality check, but it also points to something systemic, and it shouldn't make us comfortable to say there's the racist. It should make us think about the current state of our country.
Well, right, and what is the bigger issue, that overt racism expressed, or the moderation of those who don't have a problem with it or are hesitant to criticize it? I mean, that's part of the conversation as well. Why don't you go ahead and read the second thing that you have brought with you? This is from one of Dr. King's books.
Right. So, again, I referenced the Why We Can't Wait. Which he wrote in frustration. And I'm not laughing because it's funny, but again, people continue to be frustrated with the school systems and, you know, the resegregation. And so, again, it's timely to read in 2018. So Dr. King wrote, "Our nation was born in genocide when it embraced the doctrine that the original American, the Indian, was an inferior race. Even before there were a large number of Negroes on our shore, the scar of racial hatred had already disfigured colonial society. From the 16th century forward, blood flowed in battles over racial supremacy. we are perhaps the only nation which tried as a matter of national policy to wipe out its indigenous population. Moreover, we elevated the tragic experience into a noble crusade. Indeed, even today, we have not permitted ourselves to reject or feel remorse for this shameful episode. Our literature, our films, our drama, our folklore all exalt it. Our children are still taught to respect the violence which reduced a redskin people of an entire or an earlier culture into a fragmented group herded into impoverished reservations. And so for me, in my work, in my scholarship, you know, Dr. King in the early 60s also talked about the multiracial unity. And whereas the civil rights was, yes, very much about the African-American struggle, self-determination by Native communities was happening simultaneously. We just, similar to what we were alluded to, we were never taught that. Mm-hmm. You know, so we don't know, we aren't taught about Alcatraz. We aren't taught about Wounded Knee. We don't talk about mm-hmm. AIM. We don't talk about all the self-determination happening simultaneous to mm-hmm. the civil rights movement in Native communities. And I really appreciate, I always appreciate how Dr. King was contextually aware of other things happening mm-hmm. and acknowledged them. And even when I was doing research and doing some quick Google searches, this quote comes up. And I think it is unique that he did acknowledge that there was other things mm-hmm. going on. He stayed focused, but at the same time, being cognizant of contextually everything is just unique.
Right. He understood that oppression was not limited to African Americans. Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the colonization that happened to natives, you know, he made reference to colonization in Africa. And mm-hmm. so, you know, again, drawing these parallels. And when I teach the multicultural history of the United States, I think sometimes we are taught that all of this happened in silos. Mm-hmm. And I think many ways that is done purposefully. Mm-hmm. My students hear me talk about this all the time. We are taught that there's the African American struggles, the Native struggles, the Latino, Hispanic, you know, struggles, Asian American. Mm-hmm. We are taught that mm-hmm. all happened independently and those paths should not cross over. And that really is part of the master narrative. And how we are taught.
Divide and conquer.
Yes, it's taught purposely. And Dr. King called for multiracial unity. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I firmly believe he meant it. Mm-hmm. But that's something that we still in 2018, we have so much trouble. You know, we, heaven forbid if we, you know, talk about similarities or we come together. Mm-hmm. Imagine what would happen if we actually all came together as communities. Mm-hmm. You know, and I can't help think that was part of why that passage landed in that book.
Mm-hmm.
Again, he was mm-hmm. such a visionary.
And he himself was such a unifying force
yes.
and drawn upon by so many peoples. I mean, little white boy here felt, you know, in the 1960s so energized by him and connected to him mm-hmm. because, and this is going to sound like a joke and it's going to sound pathetic, but everybody finds their own entry point. I felt oppressed in my family setting.
Sure.
And I felt that I didn't have a voice. And that was how I took my first baby step into mm-hmm. understanding a much mm-hmm. wider concept of social justice.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Wow. Well, Dr. Shaler, you have something that you want to share as well, which is from an even earlier book called Stride Toward Freedom, in which we hear from Dr. King and what he had to say about nonviolent activism and what that really is about.
Yes, and I'll just go right into it. He lays out six principles of nonviolent resistance, which is both, I think, it's a philosophical underpinning rather than a program for how to enact it. So he says, first, it must be emphasized that nonviolent resistance is not a method for cowards. It does resist. If one uses this method because one is afraid or merely because one lacks the instruments of violence, this person is not truly nonviolent. This is why Gandhi often said that if cowardice is the only alternative to violence, it is better to fight. He made this statement conscious of the fact that there is always another alternative. No individual or group need submit to any wrong, nor need they use violence to right the wrong. There is always the way of nonviolent resistance. This ultimately is the way of the strong person.
Mm-hmm.
A second basic fact that characterizes nonviolence is that it does not seek to defeat or humiliate the opponent.
Yeah.
but to win his friendship and understanding. The nonviolent resistor must often express protest through non-cooperation and boycotts, but the resistor realizes that these are not ends in themselves. They are merely means to awaken a sense of moral shame in the opponent. The end is redemption and reconciliation. The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community, while the aftermath of violence is tragic bitterness. A third characteristic of this method is that the attack is directed against forces of evil rather than against persons who happen to be doing the evil. Mm-hmm. It is evil that the nonviolent resistor seeks to defeat, not the persons victimized by evil. If she is opposing racial injustice, the nonviolent resistor has the vision to see that the basic tension is not between races. As I like to say to the people in Montgomery, quote, tension in this city is not between white people and Negro people. The tension is at bottom between justice and injustice, between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. And if there is a victory, it will be a victory not merely for 50,000 Negroes, but a victory for justice and the forces of light. We are out to defeat injustice and not the white persons who may be unjust. Mm-hmm. A fourth point that characterizes nonviolent resistance is a willingness to accept suffering without retaliation, to accept blows from the opponent without striking back. Quote, rivers of blood may have to flow before we gain our freedom, but it must be our blood, close quote, Gandhi said to his countrymen. The nonviolent resistor is willing to accept violence if necessary, but never to inflict it. He does not seek to dodge jail. If going to jail is necessary, he enters it, and again quoting Gandhi, as a bridegroom enters the bride's chamber. A fifth point concerning nonviolent resistance is that it avoids not only external physical violence, but also internal violence of spirit. The nonviolent resistor not only refuses to shoot his opponent, but he also refuses to hate him. At the center of nonviolence stands the principle of love. The nonviolent resistor would contend that in the struggle for human dignity, the oppressed people of the world must not succumb to the temptation of becoming bitter or indulging in hate campaigns. To retaliate in kind would do nothing but intensify the existence of hate in the universe. Along the way of life, someone must have sense enough and morality enough to cut off the chain of hate. This can only be done by projecting the ethic of love to the center of our lives. And finally, a sixth basic fact about nonviolent resistance is that it is based on the conviction that the universe is on the side of justice. Consequently, the believer in nonviolence has deep faith in the future, for the resistor knows that in the struggle for justice, he and she have cosmic companionship. Whether we call it an unconscious process, an impersonal Brahman, or a personal being of matchless power and infinite love, there is a creative force in this universe that works to bring the disconnected aspects of reality into a harmonious whole.
There's a lot there to take
Thank
in.
Thank you for letting me.
But, wow.
Yeah, share all that.
There's all kinds of things, and I certainly want to hear from the two of you as well. I'm struck by the last one and the fact that Dr. King, who was also certainly deeply steeped in the Christian faith, and that was his own perspective, was in a sense willing to step beyond that and use also language that would mean something to mm-hmm. somebody out of mm-hmm. other traditions or of no faith tradition whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And not everybody has sort of the presence of mind nor the ability, really, to speak that eloquently outside of, in a sense, who they are and how they see the world.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And also, I notice in this passage that his use of mixed gender pronouns,
yes. mm-hmm.
a
yes.
lot of she's, yes. mm-hmm. as
I wondered
well as
if,
he's,
I wondered if
which,
that was
talk
something.
Talk about being ahead of his time.
Yes.
No, I didn't do that. That was
not
that
a Shalerism,
Dr. King,
huh?
1958.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, and I would just think that his study of the scriptures would lend it to that, because mm-hmm. when you look at the Hebrew and the Greek, and that's probably mm-hmm. for another discussion, yeah. there are gender neutral, you know, pronouns mm. and
wow.
so mm-hmm. again, I think his learning, his education informed and gave him that broad yeah. vision of how mm. to approach people. And I believe that it's his preparation as a preacher that that helped him do that in his writing.
Yes.
It seems to me that we should spend a little time with the fifth point, which is that one not only avoids physical violence, but also internal violence of spirit, that the nonviolent resistor not only refuses to shoot his opponent, but he also refuses to hate him. So it seems to me that at the moment in our country, no matter which side of the aisle you reside, that that a lot of the a lot of what is going on feels permeated with hatred, and it's hard to know what one does with that. I mean, how do you maintain your intensity, the ferocity of your sense of what is right, without stepping across that line that Dr. King is talking about here? How does one do that?
Well, in the conflict program at the university, we address issues like immigration and tax reform and all kinds of things, and we have dialogues. And so we work on that in class. And, you know, there's some very simple principles. We're not on social media, which just by its very structure can put people into silos and create kind of a soundbite, antagonistic, grandstanding kind of approach to dealing with conflict. But we listen and we emphasize the principle of love, if you want to use the word. We emphasize the fact that we're all human beings and that we all have a piece of the truth. So we need to listen to each other.
Hmm. It seems to me, I don't remember whose reading it was, but something else that was read this morning talked about, in a sense, attacking the evil itself and not the individual person who might, at least as far as we're concerned, embody that evil or be living from that evil place or evil perspective. But that's also something that, especially right now in the current climate, I think is very hard to avoid. I mean, whether you're on this side and you hate this figure over here, or you're over here and you hate that figure over there, it just seems like we are very much driven by the personal right now in a way that can be counterproductive, at least to what Dr. King was talking about.
I think the narrative, though, the larger narrative wants it to be hate more so than that arc towards justice and issues. And I don't think as many people hate each other as many people fear each other and fear the unknown and are don't just understand each other's experiences. So I'm not fear. Willing to say that there is as much hate as there is fear. I think there's a segment of the population that is just very afraid, and they've not been listened to.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's fear that can look like hate.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even to the person delivering it might not even be real, might not fully realize how much it is about fear, fearing someone or fearing something.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's a good distinction to make.
Yeah, and part of me worries about the lack of face-to-face conversation, you know, and we've all alluded to that, you know, but I think there's just, I think it's fear. So, you know, I prefer dialoguing. I prefer talking one-on-one, but I think people just, that makes them uncomfortable because then all of a sudden you have to look someone in the eye and you might be expressing something that they disagree with and not knowing how they're going to respond. And I think that's something that is an unfortunate trend. I think social media allows people to say things without, because you don't see people's reaction. You can be extremely hurtful without having to look someone in the eye and say, you know, this is what I think, and be willing to be patient and dialogue and walk away with, even though you may disagree, at least you took the time.
But where are the opportunities to do that? Do we live in such an individualized, consumer-oriented, high-paced life that those opportunities are few and far between? I think it's maybe contingent upon not only people in higher education, but more broadly to create more of those opportunities.
Yeah. And that's unfortunate, you know, that mm-hmm. that's not encouraged and that we aren't having more conversations.
I was trying to pull up a quotation. Here it is. This is from a book that I just interviewed the authors, Lee Berman and Jeremy Bernard, who are past social secretaries at the White House. Lee Berman under George W. Bush, Jeremy Bernard under Barack Obama, and they co-wrote this book called Treating People Well, The Extraordinary Power of Civility at Work and in Life. Wonderful, wonderful book. Mm-hmm. But one of the quotes that I pulled from it is, we live in a world of constant communication, but lackluster listening.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
And of course, if one is lackluster listening, probably keeps it from being the truest kind of communication too. There's a lot of talking maybe, but not enough communicating mm-hmm. Going on.
Yeah.
So
what was the title of that book again?
Treating People Well.
And the authors?
Lee Berman and Jeremy Bernard.
Thanks.
So yeah. And my interview is airing on Wednesday, by the way. So is there cause for hope? Is there cause for hope?
So I have one final quote, if that's okay.
Yeah.
So I saw it this morning while Renee and I were talking. So I think there is, but I think we have to remember that, like Dr. King said, our lives begin to end the day we become silent about the things that matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I firmly believe in that. I think we need to find our voice no matter how hard it is.
Mm.
Because, you know, the things that matter are truly important. It's just when we don't take the opportunity or take the chance to articulate them.
Right. That's Heather Kind, Keppel Diversity and Inclusion Officer at UW-Parkside. Renee Sarton-Kirby, are you hopeful for the future?
There's always hope. I think the human spirit believes in it, needs it. As I look at my granddaughters, my grandchildren, I am hopeful that their generation sees more individuals who are like each other than are different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well put. Dr. Jonathan Shaler, do you have hope, and where does your hope come from?
I do. I see emerging movements across the country that people are educating each other and are organizing in response to our political climate today. I also have a young son who is a beautiful human being, and I believe there are many more like him who are going to help lead our country
yes.
in the decades to come. So, yes.
Yeah. I mean, No, I think our children, I would be remiss to not mention my own that are out there listening right now, and I would be remiss. I think we have a lot of hope, and I think it's a lot of work as parents and grandparents, which all three of us are parents and grandparents, and it's a lot of work, but our children truly are our future.
Absolutely. Before we go, Dr. Shaler, mention the class that is going to be starting up on the 5th of February on conflict analysis and intervention.
Yeah, so here's one way to be part of the solution. Take this class. It's through continuing ed at University of Wisconsin-Parkside. You can easily find this online if you Google UW-Parkside Continuing Education Conflict Management. And the course is conflict analysis and intervention. It's a one credit. I'm sorry, it's a one-module non-credit course that runs for 5 weeks. There's an initial meeting on February 5th. I believe that's a Friday. And then there are 4 weeks of class, three of them online. The final week is another meeting face-to-face. And we'll talk about how to have difficult conversations and how to manage the emotional angst that occurs during those conversations and how to build bridges rather than to do things that are destructive in conversation.
Sounds fantastic. Dr. Jonathan Shaler, Professor of Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, thank you so much for helping to put this program together today and for bringing two extraordinary women along with you today for this conversation about Dr. King. Thank you for that. Renee Sarton-Kirby, Heather Kind Keppel, it was great to have both of you with us here as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg.
Very best wishes to you. Tomorrow on the morning show, we preview an American Experience documentary airing on PBS called The Secret of Tuxedo Park, which tells the story of an extraordinary but largely forgotten American who really helped to shape scientific research.